This is Pop Health Week on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm Greg Masters, your co-host and executive producer. Joining me in the virtual studio is co-founder and principal co-host Fred Goldstein. Fred also wears the hat of president at Accountable Health, LLC. Pop Health Week is a go-to platform for peer-to-peer conversation with industry leaders, innovators, and ecosystem stakeholders, including payers, providers, patients, vendors, and the regulatory communities. We come together to swap the best ideas and strategies in population health management. Connect with us via www.popupstudio.productions or drop me a direct message on Twitter via @GregMastersMPH, and that's Greg with two G's. You can reach Fred direct via Twitter @FSGoldstein or www.accountablehealthllc.com. On this episode, we are in the company of David Muhlstein, PhD, JD, a healthcare research executive with strategy, management, product development, business development, and publication experience. He was formerly the Chief Research and Innovation Officer for Health Management Associates and Levitt Partners, where he was the Chief Strategy and Research Officer. Muhlstein's research and expertise centers on healthcare payment and delivery transformation, understanding healthcare markets, and evaluating how the broader healthcare system is changing. Additionally, he is a visiting policy fellow at the Margolis Center for Health Policy at Duke University and is a visiting fellow at the Accountable Care Learning Collaborative. He previously served as adjunct assistant professor of the Dartmouth Institute at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. Muhlstein earned his PhD in Health Services Management and Policy, JD, MA, and MS from The Ohio State University. And with no further delay, Fred, the mic is yours.
Thanks so much, Greg. David, welcome to Pop Health Week.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to get you on. I've known you for quite a while. Thanks so much first for being willing to participate and do an interview for my class, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. It means a lot to me and to the students. They get some great advice, so I really appreciate that.
Always enjoy it.
Well, let's start, David. Why don't you provide our audience with a sense of your background, really fascinating work you've done over the years.
Sure. So I'm a health services researcher by training, so done a lot with quantifying the effects of legislation and regulation. And specifically the last dozen years or so, I've really been focused on value-based care. So how does payment reform impact delivery reform, and what works, what doesn't work, and what some of those challenges and opportunities are. For a number of years, I worked for Levitt Partners and followed that at HMA as a consultant. So did a lot of work working with organizations that are grappling with the challenges of value-based care, and most recently have gone on my own and I'm working on a value-based care company that's in development.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Obviously, I've read a lot of your stuff. When you talk about value-based care, what are you actually meaning?
Yeah, it's a great question. So value-based care to me is really a change in the business model for care where people are focused around lowering the cost of care and improving the quality of care, but they have all of the mechanisms, the systems, the people, the technology that are in place that are really optimized around that. I distinguish that from a fee-for-service model where the incentive is really around quantity. The value-based care is really where, how are you trying to limit the unnecessary care and really have some sort of a mechanism to drive that change?
So this really sort of started, it was really pre-ACA, but ACA really was this lever or the impetus for us to begin moving into this. Over the years, we've seen these changes to ACA and the Affordable Care Act and ACOs, et cetera. Where are we? How has that progressed? And what does it look like now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first, I'll maybe talk about what I consider kind of the changing definitions of what people talk about for what value-based care encompasses. And then maybe I'll talk about where I'm viewing us as a country right now. So if you go back to the earliest days of people thinking around value-based care, the equivalent of it, it was back after Medicare and Medicaid passed. So shortly after these programs passed in 1965, the cost of care started to go up pretty quickly. People recognized this and said, well, the incentive is for people to just do all the care they possibly can because they're going to get paid more. And so they said, well, let's try to encourage doctors and hospitals to keep people healthy. We want to maintain health. And that's how we created the health maintenance organizations. Well, as we know, that started out kind of pie in the sky. This is going to be great. But then it turned into more of an insurance mechanism to withhold care at times. And there were lots of complaints. So prior authorization and gatekeeping and all of those things that people really didn't like. And so said, let's go back to the drawing board. So we quit using the HMO term. The next one was really this ACO model, which was our term, which is accountable care. So we say we want providers to be accountable for the care that they're providing. And we use that for a number of years. It's still being used today, just like HMOs are. But now it's kind of narrowed to a specific subset of organizations that we call ACOs. The next kind of one is, I think it was really the population health. They said, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take a population and keep them healthy. And so we moved to the term of pop health. And so we used that for a while. We had some payment models. We had a lot of companies. We have podcasts that have adopted that term. And I think of that as a kind of an overarching term that's really saying you're responsible for a broad group of people. Well, the current iteration now is we've moved to value-based care. So value-based care certainly encompasses those other efforts. But the way that I think of it is people are making saying it's even broader, where you may not be focused on an entire population. Maybe you're doing value-based arrangements for episodes of care. So you could do that with bundles and things like that. Or maybe we're going to do it where you're not responsible for a full population, but part of a population and maybe a subset of the care. So maybe some sort of subcapitation for primary care or something, or any of dozens of other models that we're seeing for primary care, for specialties, and the like. So I think there's kind of been an evolution of this term. And so I'll start with what's happening with that broader one, the kind of accountable care, which is larger organizations that are taking defined risk for larger populations. In the MSSP, it's 5,000 or more lives. In the commercial, they tend to be a little bit larger. But we look at this, there was pretty fast growth right before the passage of the ACA and then immediately after. And there was really a focus on driving the growth of these organizations that were saying, we're going to take full risk for these populations. In recent years, actually about the last 5 years, we've kind of seen a plateauing of that. And what that means is that we have about the same number of organizations that are ACOs today as there were 5 years ago, and about the same number of lives that are being covered under these models. But that's not the whole story, because it's not like everybody that wanted to become an ACO became one. We see pretty significant churn within that. So every year there's people that come in and there's people that leave. And so there's a number that have been in it for a very long time, for over a decade, and others that come in and try for a year or two or three and then step out, and others that stick with it. And so that's kind of where we've seen this plateauing of these, what I think of as the full population health, full risk bearing providers. But what we've seen more recently, though, is a growth of these other alternative models that still encourage the improvement of quality and the reduction of costs, but they don't have full population risk involved with that. And so we're starting to see a bunch of these models come out of CMMI and in the commercial sector, where, you know, there's still providers that are starting to take some sort of risk, but maybe not the amount of risk that the HMOs were intended to take or that the ACOs were intended to take.
And so when you talk about taking risk for a smaller population, I consider it, when I look at population health, I say, okay, you could do the whole population, or maybe my population is just people with diabetes, or my population is just the patients in my clinic, or individuals who are getting their knees replaced. Are those the subsets of programs you're talking about versus the more global ACOs?
Right. And so an example of that is, let's take an orthopedic procedure. So if somebody needs to get a knee replacement, maybe what you're going to do is say you are going to be responsible for all those that enter into the pathway to get their knee replaced. And you're going to be responsible for everything related to orthopedic care for 30 or 60 or 90 days. And so, yes, there is some sort of risk. They are managing that population, but it's a subset of the whole population. Obviously, it's just those that are getting a knee replacement. It's finite in time, and it's also defined in scope. So if your person who had a knee replacement is then diagnosed with cancer, you're not responsible to become an oncologist to start taking care of that. It's just as it relates to that. And so it's ways of I would say, tailoring it for the skill sets of those providers who otherwise might not be willing to move into these risk-based models. Mm-hmm. Primary care, for example, is generally involved with care for all conditions. So they're not providing all of that care directly, but they're familiar with it. They're treating people that have these conditions. It's very difficult for specialists to really kind of undertake that, for most specialists. So it's saying, well, let's just, instead of saying that you're going to be nominally responsible for a lot, let's just focus around what your expertise is and kind of what your capabilities are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And let me get back to something you talked about, and it's always a question I have when we talk about value-based care. And typically you see value-based care is quality over cost, and you see that lovely little display or equation out there. But when we talk about value-based care, value to whom? Because
That
obviously you
is
have
a
the
magical
patient.
question. There's a bunch of different people that you say, who could it be basically there? And the simplistic answer is, well, it should be value to everybody. The challenge is that rarely does that really play out. There's obviously the patient where you say we want to improve the health of that patient and see how that impacts them. But then it's the cost. Is it the cost of the patient? Is it the cost to the purchaser who's there? So it's maybe value to the employer who's paying for that. Maybe it's value for those that are providing the care themselves. So there's some that is saying it's value to the individual practitioners or maybe the group that's responsible to that. In general, I think of it as a much broader level. So I think of it as a societal level. And that means, in the aggregate, are we improving the quality of care that we have across the entire country? And are we lowering the cost that we're spending on healthcare within the entire nation? And what I mean by that is that it's not just pushing sand around the sandbox. It's not saying, well, a little bit less money to the insurers and more to the providers and more. It's, are we actually taking sand out of the sandbox? And so that's how I like to think of it, is at the macro level, are we reducing the total spend and are we maintaining or improving the total health at the population level?
Right. And so when you then filter that down through those three areas, let's say the patient, the provider, and the payer, you would say that as we've taken the sand out, we've distributed it relatively equally so that the patient isn't picking up more of their copay versus the payer who's then taking the savings, et cetera. Correct?
That's the idea. Yeah. Does it work in
Fantastic.
practice? It depends.
So let's get to that. Where are we with these? So is it making a difference? Are we seeing
Yeah. So there's two different answers to that. So
it?
one is program level evaluation, and then other is looking at macro trends. So I'm going to start with the program level evaluation. So the program is saying, let's look at specific models that have been introduced. So the Medicare Shared Savings Program, or any of the primary care models that have come out, CBC Plus, those type of models where you're saying, what's really happening? Best evidence that I've seen is that there is a modest decrease in cost growth over time. So that's from my research and research of others, is saying that we are expecting a certain trend and we are modestly below that trend. How much is that? Probably in the 0.5% to 2% range, depending on the year, depending on the program. And depending on what you're using as your counterfactual, that's always a challenge getting the right counterfactual from a research standpoint. You might see that there is no statistically significant difference for some programs, and others you'll say for a subset of the program, there's a meaningful difference. And there's a variety of things, but they're not increasing costs. Nobody have found that. And those that have found a decrease in costs have found very modest reductions. So that's that program level evaluation. It's also happened on the commercial side, that for those that have been adequately studied. We also, though, have a concurrent macro trend. The macro trend in the country is that our cost growth has not proceeded at the pace that it had in decades past. So we have stabilized for close to the last decade at a similar GDP spend on healthcare. Now, the question is, have all of these different efforts, these individual programs, influenced that? And it's really hard to disentangle that. And I would say that it's unknown. But what we have seen is that there has been some decrease. And so can we attribute it to value-based care? No. But is it concurrent with value-based care? It is. And that's something that I would love to really look in a little bit more and see if we can disentangle that a little bit. Because the challenge that you have is you say, well, if all of these programs are having a spillover effect to those that are not in the programs, well, then those are lousy counterfactuals. You can't use them to do a comparison against. So in the aggregate, though, we have seen a stabilization, I shouldn't say a stabilization, but a decrease in the growth of our total healthcare spend relative to what we saw in previous decades.
And when you say similar GDP growth, what you mean is before we used to be usually 2x of GDP or something, healthcare was growing that, and now it's growing at a similar rate to what we see as a growth in GDP, correct?
Right. And so for the past number of years, we've been 16 to 18% of our GDP has been spent on healthcare. It depends on which definition you use of GDP and of healthcare. But we've been relatively consistent across time with that in the last few years. Previously, it was, well, we're 12% this year. Next year, we're 13 and then 14. And there's right. a pretty aggressive slope. So we've roughly approximately grown at the same pace as the economy in recent years.
For those just joining us, we're in the company of David Muhlstein, PhD, JD, a healthcare research executive with strategy, management, product development, business development, and publication experience. He was formerly the Chief Research and Innovation Officer for Health Management Associates and Levitt Partners, where he was the Chief Strategy and Research Officer. Stay tuned for the rest of the story.
Yeah, and I think my error was saying GDP versus rate of inflation or the growth rate of that, where we're seeing that the healthcare inflation rate come down relative to the growth we're seeing elsewhere. So it's similar and not expanding at a rapid, more mm-hmm. rapid rate. So when you think about that and you say to yourself, well, we've seen plenty of these studies that show 25 to 40% of healthcare is excess, waste, fraud, abuse. Is there any way we can get it to go negative and take that stuff out?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a challenge. The short answer is that if you look at any sort of a quality measure, and then you ask somebody why their quality is lower, they're going to say, well, it's because I have different patients, and I want a second opinion. You know, and there's always a second opinion about what's needed and what isn't. And so one person's definition will say that a third of care is waste. Another person's definition is saying, well, a third of care is missed. So we should actually be doing a lot more. And that's first is you just have to recognize that there is not consensus around that there's waste there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Given that, I am a firm believer that there is a lot of care that is being provided that is not needed for patients. There's two challenges with addressing that. The first challenge is that oftentimes you don't know in advance what care is needed or not. Use an example. Somebody is in a major automobile accident. They have head pain, severe headache that's lasting for days. They're in the hospital and you do an MRI. The MRI finds absolutely nothing. Well, in retrospect, you could say that was wasted because it didn't provide any value, but it did provide value. It was saying that things weren't done. Many times that's the case that we have is that there's care that may not have actually been needed. And that's actually one of the challenges that ACOs and other population-based companies have is that the fastest way to be unsuccessful financially is to provide benefits for patients that don't really need that. And that's really hard. So which of your diabetics need aggressive monitoring and lifestyle coaching? Well, some of them would certainly benefit from that and others maybe not. Actually, for sure, not all of them are going to benefit from that. And that can be from any disease, any population, is that you could provide things that for some people would be very valuable and improve their health. And other things are going to have no impact on their health. And that's what I mean by waste, is that a service that does not have any impact on somebody's health. Mm-hmm. So that's the first challenge, is that it's just a challenge to do it. The second challenge that really makes it difficult is it's easy in the aggregate to see that there's issues that are there. We can say, look, there's lots of these challenges. We can look at the rates of these things versus population prevalence of diseases. And you can really quickly say, there are challenges here. This is what the Dartmouth Atlas introduced us to decades ago, which is saying disparate utilization of services suggests that they're not all needed in the same volume. How do you take that population level view and apply it at the individual level in a meaningful way that actually moves the needle and consistently does that? That's one of these biggest challenges that organizations have that are moving toward risk, is how do you take these big ideas and then help people so that they're able to make a different decision at the point of care that actually leads to these better outcomes? And I think that I'd suggest that that's a real challenge that we have not cracked the nut of yet, is how do you take these needs and then implement it at the bedside level?
Mm-hmm. Got it. And, you know, I'm thinking about some examples of waste issues. And one of them was, I was talking to a friend of mine who was involved in a clinical team, and they saw that within one particular clinic, one of the health plans was requiring a prior authorization on this one product. And they went back and looked after a year and identified that, yes, they'd spent quite a bit of time for the staff to come up with that prior auth and fill it out and send it in. And at the end of a year, there had been not a single one of those denied. So you know, there's this person doing all this work for all this time. So they actually called the health plan and said, why are you doing this? And the health plan in that case actually stopped it. And I think, you know, those are clear examples, or the Walmart example of back surgeries, where you're seeing 40% sent back saying they don't need it after talking to what they consider a center of excellence. And are those kinds of things a possibility to begin to see as tools or ways to implement some of this?
Yeah, for sure. So the first one that you talked about is administrative waste. And right. this is, how are we going to do the same thing, but do it more efficiently? There are countless opportunities in healthcare that you can do things more efficiently. And it's not just on the, you know, the insurance side, prior authorizations, Absolutely. Things like that, or the billing side. It can be everything from the pharmacy side, and how do you get people things more efficiently and quickly, to the provider side, to how do you do the same procedure that you were doing, but use fewer resources, so fewer inputs that are going into that. So much opportunity there. And but then the question, though, is this just an issue of pushing sand around the sound box? Or let's say that we do become more efficient. Let's say a provider becomes significantly more efficient. They're 20% more efficient at doing a procedure. Okay, should they be paid 20% less? And now the payer takes 20% less in premiums, equivalent premiums for that. Well, a lot of people say, well, no, the payer should get part of it and the provider should get part of it, but then you leave the patient out of it and they're still paying the same amount. But that's the thing that I think should happen, is that not only do we need to drive this, but we also need to take those savings out of the system. Don't just say, oh, you're more efficient, we're going to pay you more.
And that's a great point. That gets to this whole 85% medical loss ratio or 80% medical loss ratio, where in effect, as a health plan, who would want to create a healthier population if the next year your premiums have to drop and you're getting 15% of a smaller number? So I've always sort of argued with that. There needs to be Exactly. a range where some of that savings is allowed to be maintained for doing better, and some of it brings your premiums down and impacts the rest of the group.
Yeah. If you can lower the total cost, why not have a higher margin? I mean, I have no problem with that. If you're reducing everybody's costs, then I don't think the margin should be capped at any level. I also understand the policy of why they put in MLRs.
Yes.
Because of other incentives that are in place, but they're certainly not a panacea. They don't solve all the issues. They solve some and create others.
Absolutely. So when you think about this, and you mentioned sort of working through the terminology as we went from these various groups through population health and now value-based care, is population health still relevant?
Of course. Yeah, we have an aging population. We have, because of advances in medical science, we have people that live much longer with chronic conditions, and so they need regular care over time. We have to do this and rethink healthcare in a different way. The medical model was built around the idea that people were sick, you would treat them, and then they would get healthy. And that's not the reality that we live in today. Is our population, previously, you know, if somebody had diabetes, they would live for a few years with that. If somebody had renal failure, they would live for a few months and then they would die. Now we have people that have multiple chronic conditions that they're never going to get better from, but they're going to be lived and they need to be treated and needs to be managed in a way that's very different. It's not come with a problem, I solve your problem and you go home. It is come and we are going to work together and we're going to manage you for decades to help you live as healthy as you possibly can. That is a fundamental difference from where we were 50 or 60 years ago, when a lot of these payment models were originally conceived. And we have to do that. We have to address that.
You've obviously looked at this really broadly and deeply. And when you read your stuff and what you've studied and the data you put out in the reports, are there areas that excite you that you think are going to make a fundamental difference and continue to show improvements in what we're doing?
Yeah. So I'll highlight two areas that really get me excited. So the first one is organizations that are starting from the ground up with a completely different delivery system. So organizations that aren't saying, oh, we've got 100 years being a hospital that's always had focus on heads and beds, but saying, we're going to say, let's start with something and we're going to build the facilities, the technology, all of those different things from the ground up and say, let's build this as if we could start from scratch, because they are in effect starting from scratch. Those are the companies that excite me. There's a lot that are in the advanced primary care space. So the Oak Street Healths and the Caremores of the world that fall under that. But this can be in anything. It can be disease management. It can be in employer health. But anybody that's saying, let's start with a blank slate and rethink things and rebuild and really restart what's there. I think that's one area that really excites me. The other area that really does excite me that I've been spending more time on is how can we drive the healthcare system to actually compete on cost. So I'm a very big believer that when people compete on cost and quality, the costs drop and the quality goes up. So use an example of this. If you just go back 30 years, there were cell phones. And for $1,000 of, you know, money from 1993, you could buy a cell phone and it functioned. You could make calls with that. $1,000 today, you can get a cell phone that will do orders of magnitude more than what that same cell phone did before. And if you don't have the money to buy a $1,000 cell phone, you can go get a brand new cell phone for less than $100 that will do more than the fastest computers in the world could do 20 years ago. And the reason for that is that there was an incentive to improve the quality and to lower the cost. And so there's all sorts of different price points that are there, and the quality is across and the ranges of quality, but even the lowest quality is significantly improved to what the best quality was just a few decades ago. There has not been the same incentive in healthcare for people to aggressively compete on cost and quality. And there's myriad reasons for that. And I won't go to those, but there's countless reasons that are really impacting the disability of people to get the healthcare system to compete in cost and quality. One of the major ones, though, is that there has been no transparency data. We frankly didn't know what the cost was, but there have been major releases of data. And so we're starting to get access to that. And I think that over time, it's not going to happen overnight, but over the coming decade, we're going to see more and more providers that, not because there's a top-down effort from the government, it's going to be a bottom-up force where the market tells them, you now have to compete on cost and quality because we know what your quality is, we know what your cost is, and that is going to give people incentives to actually start to compete on that. I'm a firm believer that there are procedures today that cost tens of thousands of dollars that could be replaced with procedures that cost singles thousands of dollars. There just has not been the impetus to create that yet, but it will come. So those are two areas that I'm excited about.
Well, that's really a fantastic way to end this show. Thanks so much for providing such a great look into this area of value-based care, the different models, et cetera. It's a pleasure to get you on Pop Health Week. Thanks, David.
Thanks for having me, Fred. It was a pleasure.
And back to you, Greg.
And there you have it, folks. That's a wrap for today's broadcast. We want to extend appreciation to our worldwide listeners for tuning in and our deep gratitude to David Muhlsteins, PhD, JD, for his insights today. Keep up with David's work on LinkedIn and on Twitter via @DavidMuhlstein, and that's Muhlesteein. If you find our Pop Health Week content as engaging as we do, please show your support. Give us a thumbs up on your favorite podcast platform. Share it with your colleagues and do subscribe to ensure you don't miss on future episodes. Remember, we're live on Healthcare Now Radio weekdays at 5:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 9:30 p.m. Eastern. And for our friends on the West Coast, that's 2:30 a.m., 10:30 a.m., and 6:30 p.m. Pacific. From all of us at Pop Health Week, Fred Goldstein, and yours truly, Greg Masters, we urge you to stay safe and stay tuned. Until next time, fare thee well.